Today is Thursday, July 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Independence Day in America, and President Trump takes the spotlight in the nation's capital.
What we celebrate on the 4th of July is not military. It's not weapons. It's not tanks. What we celebrate on the 4th of July is a country becoming free.
Japan resumes commercial whaling, but activists say it never stopped. Also ahead, a pop star's new provocative video is all about female empowerment. It's all on today's International Edition. The celebration of the United States' 243rd birthday looks different this year as President Trump stages his own military-themed celebration in addition to the now traditional ceremony at the U.S. Capitol. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on how the capital city, Washington, D.C., is preparing.
A sight and sound familiar to almost every American. Independence Day celebrations on Capitol Hill. But on the other end of the National Mall, preparations underway for a second new celebration, President Donald Trump's salute to America.
That's the American way, right? We want to do something grandiose, something that's spectacular.
Grucci, one of two companies donating fireworks for the event, a contribution recognized in a tweet by the president, who has promised the biggest celebration ever, including a display of tanks. Those tanks leading some to say the president is militarizing what should be a nonpartisan national holiday. Well, some said they don't mind.
I'm proud and thankful for those that have served our country and really appreciate what they've done and their families. And I'm grateful for a president who recognizes that and wants to celebrate that.
But reports Trump's celebration would be paid in part by funds diverted from U.S. national parks concerned many Democratic members of Congress, who said the money should not be spent on what amounts to a political rally for the president. White House advisor Kellyanne Conway referred questions about cost to the Department of Defense while previewing the president's speech.
Our great democracy and great call to patriotism, the success of this administration in opening up so many jobs for individuals, what we've done for veterans.
That speech, along with both fireworks celebrations, could be in jeopardy. Severe thunderstorms are forecast for Washington, D.C. the evening of the holiday. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, President Trump's 4th of July plans are not sitting well with many of his critics. They say the holiday is for everyone and shouldn't be politicized. Joining us to talk about that part of the story is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. What is your reaction to the Trump 4th of July?
I'm opposed to it. I find it very troubling. And the reason is that what we celebrate on the 4th of July is not military. It's not weapons. It's not tanks. What we celebrate on the 4th of July is a country becoming free of a big, big colonial power, Great Britain. And, you know, as you know, that's the time of the Declaration of Independence. And, you know, you can then add to that our Constitution. These are all documents reflecting the rule of law. They're not documents reflecting militarism. And to sort of put the punctuation on that, you'll notice that or as you think about it, you'll see that the dictators love these big military parades. Hitler loved them. Stalin, Khrushchev, they loved them. Mao loved them.
President Trump does seem to have an affinity for dictators, those strong-arm type leaders.
He does. He does. And I think that somehow being able to order tanks to go up Pennsylvania Avenue must give him some sort of a thrill, which I just don't understand. When I was a kid, this is during the height of the Soviet Union, you could look forward every year to the May Day parades when the Russian military, including, you know, ICBMs and so forth, would be pulled down the streets through Red Square. And, you know, we just had a very different kind of atmosphere. And what I think President Trump is doing is recreating that kind of dictatorial, militaristic sort of scene. And that's just something that we don't do in America. The military doesn't do it in America.
Some of the president's critics are saying that he's basically hijacked an otherwise nonpartisan event where presidents just don't attend, and it's just for all Americans to enjoy. But he's planning on giving some sort of a speech. There are concerns that it will have a partisan tone if he does, in fact, make this sort of a political rally or part political rally for his reelection. What will that say?
What I find interesting is the assumption that this will all work out quite smoothly. I think it's quite likely that any attempt by Mr. Trump to turn this into a partisan political rally will turn against him. Because there are certainly people that voted for Mr. Trump who don't want to see the 4th of July turned into a convention, a political convention. And so if I were he, I'd be a little nervous about how likely this is to go smoothly. There are going to be, as you know, counter-protesters, and those things can get pretty ugly.
I don't recall seeing protests on 4th of July in Washington, D.C. ever.
No, nor do I, because it isn't that kind of a holiday. It's funny, we're having this discussion. I got an email today from an old friend who has a family tradition going back 35 years that every 4th of July, they read the Declaration of Independence, as a family. They read the Declaration of Independence, the preamble to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Gettysburg Address. And he's been doing this, and he's encouraged his friends to do the same thing. And because it isn't a partisan plea, you know, it's not about are you for or against abortion, are you for or against the death penalty. It's about celebrating a nation that lives under the law.
Let's just wrap this up with the financial aspects of this. The White House is not saying how much this whole extravaganza will be costing above and beyond, you know, the normal, what it would normally cost to put on the annual 4th of July, but it is, of course, paid for by taxpayers ultimately. And the National Park Service apparently says that there have been funds diverted from the National Park Service, which apparently is already cash-strapped and short-handed about 200 law enforcement rangers.
To me, the financial aspect is the least significant. I'm opposed to it. I think it's bad governance. But that's not the key issue to me. The White House certainly is able to say to the Park Service, by the way, you just lost $20 million or $50 million or whatever the number is. I think the symbolic effect is just so wrong.
All right. That's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. Homeland Security chief orders a probe of border agents' offensive Facebook posts. U.S. hits Cuba with sanctions in a new move against Venezuela's Maduro. A deadly Libya bombing may be a war crime. And presidential candidate and Senator Kamala Harris surges in the polls after the first Democratic debate. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. French lawmakers have begun debating tough new legislation requiring tech and social media companies to swiftly remove online hate speech or risk huge fines. The bill fits broader global efforts to curb heinous and violent discourse on the internet seen after this year's mass shootings in New Zealand. But as Lisa Bryant reports from Paris for VOA, some fear the legislation could spark censorship.
The bill gives tech companies just 24 hours to remove racist and other hateful online content or risk fines of up to 4% of their global revenue. Users would be able to click a special button under offensive content to flag it.
Il ne se passe pas un jour sans que je ne reçoive une insulte raciste.
Leading the effort is French deputy Laetitia Avia, whose parents come from Togo. In interviews like this one on French TV, she describes being the victim of a daily deluge of online racist insults and says social media networks aren't doing enough to stop them. France's digital affairs minister, Cédric O, says the government hopes to drastically lower online hate content. The bill is similar to German legislation that has received mixed reviews. Other countries countries, including Britain and Australia, have imposed or are debating stricter regulations against extremism on the internet.
Mais c'est un problème que aucun pays dans le monde n'a réglé. Donc on pose une première brique.
Speaking on French radio, Minister O said the French bill is no silver bullet. No government has been able to eradicate online abuse, but he believes the legislation will lay a good base and can be revised as needed. France's centrist president, Emmanuel Macron, has prioritized cracking down on hateful and violent web content. Following the terrorist attacks in New Zealand, he helped push through a non-binding so-called Christchurch Accord in May to curb online extremism. The United States did not sign it, citing free speech concerns. Some experts have similar fears when it comes to this new bill.
Alors, oui, il y a un vrai risque de censure. Pourquoi? Parce que,
prominent media lawyer Christophe Bigot told VOA the bill may lead to censorship because tech companies may favor removing any suspect content to avoid heavy fines. He doesn't think new laws are needed, but instead more judges to apply existing anti-hate speech laws. Like Bigot, Loïc Rivière also has concerns. He's general secretary of Tech in France, which represents 400 French and international software and internet companies.
Alors, on n'aurait pas de problème, sauf peut-être que le délai de 24 heures.
Rivière agrees with the bill's broad goals. Online hate has become massive, he says, too big for the justice system alone to handle. But he says the legislation opens up too many gray areas, and the 24-hour deadline is too short for removing hateful content. Tech companies will need government support to be effective. France's lower house will vote on the bill next week before the Senate takes it up. The measure could become law in a few months. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
In 1981, Mauritania became the last country in the world to abolish slavery, but the problem is still prevalent and the government is doing little to combat it, even though independent organizations are helping free slaves throughout the country. Victims still face hurdles in their new lives. Esha Sarai reports from Nouakchott.
Barka Mintyarba doesn't know how old she is. 8 years ago, Barka moved with her family to the capital of Nouakchott from the city of Atar, where she was born into slavery. Though she has been freed, she has no official papers and no ability to acquire documentation required to attend school or work in most jobs. For the past 8 years, Barka has been a housekeeper and a cook for a family. Barka says the work isn't too tiring and that she is happy with her life. But she still lacks identity papers, preventing her from seeking other work or pursuing her education, an education she missed as a child. Barka says she spent long childhood days watching after her master's flock. Barka is one of an unknown number of Haratin in Mauritania born into slavery. Technically made illegal in the country in the 1980s, modern slavery remains a pressing problem, though the Sahara Desert country's government denies that. Many organizations in Mauritania work with limited funds to free slaves. Among them is SOS Esclave, which is dealing with 30 open cases. Barka's mother, Oul Moulker, is one of SOS's clients whose case remains open 8 years after she was legally freed. Oul Moulker says she is still waiting for reparations and for justice for all the damage her family suffered at the hands of slave owners, who left them without education or identification papers. Besides a lack of political will to fight or acknowledge the problem, NGOs and foreign governments have accused the Mauritanian government of denying entry and access to those pursuing information on modern slavery, as well as harassing and jailing anti-slavery activists in the country. Biramda Abeid, who recently ran for president of Mauritania and has officially contested the results of the election, is one such anti-slavery activist who was previously jailed for 4 years. Abeid says that he has endured all kinds of torture and barriers to supporting his people, and that even for free slaves, systematic problems of education and housing remain. And education is a big concern for Mbarka, who recounts watching her master's children go to school and study the Quran while she did not and does not anticipate having any such opportunities. Still, Mbarka is hopeful about her future, confident that her life and the state of slavery in the country can only improve. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Nouakchott.
The United Nations says at least 55 people were killed and more than 130 injured in the Tuesday night airstrike on a detention center holding illegal migrants in Libya's capital. VOA's Heather Murdoch is on the scene in Tripoli and files this report.
Outside the Tripoli detention center holding migrants, survivors watch the investigation after a long night outside with barely any food and water. Many detainees didn't survive Tuesday's airstrike, and many more remain hospitalized.
At the beginning, we heard faraway clashes. Then we heard this strong bomb. We were banging on the doors, and the security people came and let us out, and we saw the building on fire.
The United Nations says the attack could amount to a possible war crime. Tripoli officials attribute the attack to forces loyal to Khalifa Haftar, a strongman who leads the military in eastern Libya. Haftar's forces have been locked in battle with the forces loyal to the internationally backed government in the capital, Tripoli, for 3 months. They are fighting for the city and the future of the Libyan government. The war has now killed about 700 people and displaced 94,000. Many of the detainees had been displaced several times by war, violence, and poverty before coming to Libya in the hopes of crossing the sea to Europe.
They were from Africa, Asia, and Arab countries, Bangladesh, Morocco, Egypt, Syria, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger.
Last week, after a victory by forces loyal to Tripoli, Haftar's forces threatened retaliation. Amnesty International says its research indicates there is a weapons storehouse near the destroyed detention center.
Travelers here in Tripoli say, despite the suffering they faced before getting here, and despite the hardships they face while here, they are still determined to try to get to Europe. Reporting from Tripoli in Libya, I'm Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
Well, five Japanese whaling ships set off Monday to begin the first commercial whale hunt in more than 30 years. Japan stopped commercial whaling in 1988 after the International Whaling Commission imposed a moratorium on killing the giant marine mammals. But despite the global ban, Japan continued to hunt whales for what it claimed was scientific research. Joining us now is Captain Paul Watson, an environmental activist who founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, an anti-poaching and direct action group focused on marine conservation. So thank you for being with us. You have said that the media reports of Japan restarting its whaling operations is misleading. Why?
It's misleading because Japan has never stopped commercial whaling. They'll be killing the same number of whales in their waters this year as they did last year and the 30 years before that. What has changed is they're no longer killing whales in the Southern Ocean, and that's a very positive thing. It's a very positive thing that they've left the International Whaling Commission, because that now gives the IWC the opportunity to really enact real conservation rules. Like, for instance, we will now have a South Atlantic whale sanctuary, which Japan has blocked for many years. So all in all, it's pretty good news.
I'm surprised to hear you say it's good news. You know, this has caused a lot of outrage from people, you know, conservationists who are just appalled by, you know, killing whales, particularly with everything that's happening with the environment and wildlife. You're saying that this could actually be an improvement?
It will be, because, you know, whaling has continued in Japan due to massive government subsidies that was supporting the Southern Ocean Whale Campaign. It became so expensive, like $50 million a year in security and overhead costs, and now they're faced with the fact that they're going to have to replace the Nishanmaru, their factory ship, which is about $200 million, and there just isn't the political support for that in Japan. So what they've done now is are just continuing to kill whales in their own waters, which they've done all along, but without subsidies. And what that means is that I believe that whaling's going to die a natural death, because there simply isn't a demand in Japan for it. Japan is now the number two whaling nation on the planet after Norway. Norway's number one. And Iceland's one of the worst, because it's been targeting fin whales. But we were able to stop Iceland this summer. No whales will be killed in Iceland this summer, which is good.
How did that come about?
Well, last year we documented every single whale that was being brought into the shore station. And we documented them killing two blue whales, which they cut up before the inspectors came there. Mm-hmm. So there's an investigation. And that's still under investigation. And we also sent a vessel there this summer and to put more pressure on them, and Iceland refused to issue them permits. So no permits have been issued this summer to kill whales, so no whales will be killed, and that's a good thing. So our vessels just left Icelandic waters, and we're going to be concentrating more on Norway as the number one whaling nation. But really, the great news No whaling in the Southern Ocean, no whaling in the Southern Hemisphere, no pelagic whaling. This is the first time that's ever happened in history, so we're quite happy about that.
Great. And you really get out there actively and hands-on to try to stop this. Can you just sort of give us a brief idea of how you guys work?
Well, Sea Shepherd is not a protest organization. We intervene against illegal activities, and whaling is illegal. Commercial whaling is illegal. And since 2005, we've directly been blockading Japanese whaling operations in the Southern Ocean, reducing their quotas by 30% and even down to 10%. And it's been very effective. It's cost them tens of millions of dollars, and we've got a lot of progress on that. Now they're out of there completely. The Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary is, in fact, now a sanctuary. No whales will be killed, and we will soon have the South Atlantic Whale Sanctuary. So things are progressing quite well. We're quite happy with it.
So if you're now heading to Norway, what will you do to make change there?
Well, we have in the past. We've intervened and obstructed their whaling operations, and that's something we'll continue to do. We're also opposing them on a legal front with Sea Shepherd Legal. We've been taking Iceland and Norway and Denmark to court, especially into the European Union when it involves Denmark. So we're approaching this through education. We're approaching it through legislation, through litigation, and also through direct action.
I remember being in Iceland, and I thought it was incredible that the whale watching boat and the whale murder boat were next to each other. I don't know how tourists would feel about seeing that.
Things have changed. In 1986, you know, we sank half of Iceland's whaling fleet and destroyed their whale processing plant. We shut down their operations for 17 years before they could recover. And, of course, everybody in Iceland was pretty angry at the time. But now we got a lot of support in Iceland. We have a Sea Shepherd chapter in Iceland. The prime minister is against whaling. The whale-watching industry makes more money than whaling ever has. One of the other reasons whaling has continued in Iceland is that about 30,000 meals are served to tourists every year. So American and European tourists have been actually supporting this. But we've been working on that, and many restaurants now in Reykjavik proudly display a sign saying whale meat not being served here, and we've been encouraging tourists to go to those restaurants and to also to patronize their whale watching operations.
That's Captain Paul Watson, an environmental activist who founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Our voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Nigeria's movie industry, Nollywood, for many decades has largely depended on local movie distribution. But in the last decade, producers have been shifting focus from low-budget, high-volume production to quality, earning the industry more international recognition. In 2015, America's streaming giant Netflix started streaming Nigerian-made movies. But poor internet infrastructure and high data costs mean stunted growth for streaming services in Nigeria. Timothy Obazio reports from Abuja.
Nigerian actress and filmmaker Happy Juliet has been in the industry for many years. Every year, she produces many low-budget movies to make up for low payments from local distributors and losses from piracy. But now she says she's focusing on quality, hoping that her movie gets a shot at international limelight.
We, the filmmakers, we've been suffering, and we are still suffering in the hands of these distributors. Because I don't see any reason why I should work for my money. Everything comes from me, and then you want to rip me off.
Nigeria's movie industry in Nollywood became popular and attained global recognition for its volume of production, ranked second to India's Bollywood. But that is changing. Technological advancements and online streaming are reducing the dependence of filmmakers on volume production and local distribution.
There's no how Netflix or Roku or whatever will have my movie without me giving them. That means I have collected some money from them. So any movie we see there, definitely the producer must have collected part of the money or full from them before they can afford to put it online.
But eliminating the so-called middlemen or local distributors is only a part of the solution for Nigeria's filmmakers. Poor internet infrastructure and high data costs in Nigeria means, despite involvement of international and local online streaming services with producers, viewers still struggle to access movies.
It bothered us in the beginning, but again, it made us think outside of the box. So in order to tackle that challenge, we decided to go beyond data. And we decided to de-emphasize on our streaming aspect of our business and focus more on creating an app from scratch. Aside from that, we also came up with kiosks. So what the kiosk does is that it allows for our consumers to go to the kiosk and then they can download movies.
Despite showing the fastest growth rates in internet penetration, Africa remains in the bottom rank with only about 35.2% of the population using the internet. Nigeria's government has created an enabling environment for many broadband service providers to make cheap data available. But millions of movie lovers here still depend on local distributors, a practice that promotes piracy. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Pop singer Miley Cyrus has just released a new video that is pretty provocative, but with a message about feminism. The song Mother's Daughter celebrates diversity, sexuality, pride, and empowerment. She's dressed in a deep red, full-body latex outfit in the video, where she gyrates, crawls on the floor, and uses words we can't say on this program. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. It's Independence Day in the U.S. Happy 4th of July. I'm Lori London in Washington.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA.